that was my first no. So from that, everything else becomes a little easier to say no to be honest. It's just the mindset around it. Saying no to the biggest group makes all the other smaller groups easier to decline.
Hey everybody, welcome to this week's episode of the Entrepreneur Experiment Podcast with me, Gary Fox. This week, we've got our Rising Stars series. We have picked our Rising Star for Season 8, and it is To Go Cup. Today, we're chatting to their CEO, Kevin Murphy. We go through how they started, where they are now, what the pandemic meant for them, how hospitality has changed, and what their mission is to change the entire face of coffee cups. First, quick chat from my sponsor, Sage. Working smarter is the key to success as an entrepreneur in 2022. That is why I've partnered with Sage. Sage is the trusted global provider of finance, HR, and payroll software to help small and medium businesses like me and you thrive. To learn more about Sage, go to sage.com or click the link in the pod description. If you could log on to Sage right now, you get 3 months free. So go and check that out. Now, without further ado, here is our Rising Stars series for Season 8. It is Mr. Kevin Murphy and it is To Go Cup. Kevin, welcome to the pod.
Thank you very much. Great to be here, Gary.
That is a very serene, peaceful background I'm looking at.
Garden room, very eco-friendly.
Very awesome. Eco-friendly. I'm having a coffee. You're having a coffee.
We
may as well start right there. Kevin, what do you do?
Good question. I'm the founder and CEO of To Go Cup. My name is Kevin Murphy. Should probably bring in my name at some point here. I've previously been a climate ambassador for Ontashka. I have been a special advisor to Zero Waste Scotland, and I was named a Business All-Star One to Watch. So probably easier to explain what we do by going through the problem. Global scale, naturally, of course, we're on the Entrepreneur Experiment. So there are 500 billion single-use cups used across the planet every single year. Less than 1% of these are composted, recycled, biodegraded. The obvious solution is a keep cup. And the reality is about 80% of the Irish population now own one of these, but only about 20% will actually use it. So the solution doesn't necessarily work. To give you a bit more closer to home figures, it's about 200 million single-use cups are used here in Ireland every year. It breaks down to about 550,000 every single day. I suppose the key part of what we do as To Go Cup is there's four core values. The first is we have to be cost effective. The other is we have to be affordable. We have to be just as convenient as getting your coffee as per normal on a Monday morning. And then finally, we have to be a net benefit for the environment. So the best way to kind of explain how it works, Gary, is when you pop down to your local coffee shop, absolutely nothing changes in your customer journey. You'll go in, you'll order your cappuccino, you'll pay for your cappuccino, and then you'll pay €1 extra for a to-go cup, basically a reusable cup. Go about, enjoy your day, and if you're a bit of a coffee head like myself, you'll probably pop into another cafe later that day, drop back that cup and receive your €1 back, so you've no longer spent money. Basically like the euro in the shopping trolley. Then how it works for the business is we have a completely cost-neutral structure. So if we go into Joe's Corner there and you do 700 coffees per week, we'd recommend you buy 700 cups, which will cost you 7 as per normal the next week. You'll then take in 700 €1 deposits, you hand them to us, we hand you more cups, and you start the system again. Simple as that.
That does sound simple. How do you make money if it's all free?
It's a great question. Two key parts. So firstly, we own our cup. We've gone and built it. So the best way to kind of explain how this all came about is we started with a pilot operation that ran across Dublin City Council, Trinity College and DCU back in 2019. It was supported by the EPA and the LAPN here in Ireland. Effectively, what we tried to do was remove single-use cups across several outlets in 3 organisations and see what the Irish consumers would take of it. We ran it for about 3 months and we were in the news in about 9 different countries. So that's a pilot operation. We took all this information. So we'd originally built a Starbucks cup herself, and then kind of brought it back to Ireland as they'd want. So we sell it and make a markup on that. And then equally, we have a subscription model per outlet. It's a euro per day per outlet. So if you're one coffee shop, your total cost for the year is 365. And as simple as that.
Okay, that makes sense. I get it.
Easy start.
That makes sense. Yeah, look, that's the shortest pod I think we'll ever do. So that all makes sense, right? How did this come about, though? Like, it seems like such an obvious solution now, and I've seen to-go cups all over the place, and I never really fully understood what they were. But now when you explain it, it seems so obvious. But how did this all get started? How did you kind of look beyond the kind of reusable cups you already have?
Yeah, it's a cool question. So, I'm 26 years old, so I actually started the company when I was in my internship year in DCU. I studied marketing, innovation, and technology. And essentially, how it came about was a girl beside me in our internship spilled boiling water all over herself. Terrible way to start how this all came about. And I started kind of evaluating, actually, like, these paper cups are all over an office where everyone could just use a mug to begin with. And then, you know, you're walking through town in Dublin City every day and you can't not see them then. You're kind of just so hooked into it. So I started kind of going, okay, well, like, what are the alternatives here? So even just swapping to like a reusable cup for the office, I'm keeping one extra for clients coming in and so forth, would save the company several thousand euro across their entire organization. Then I kind of fell into doing that, and inevitably I was approached by the director of sustainability in DCU, who was looking to create a deposit and return system, the first here in the country. Now, if I knew at the time that I was probably fifth or sixth down the list to even be asked, I probably wouldn't have did it. But essentially, I took it on as, okay, can this be done? And quite quickly, we developed and created a green environment team, which included the city council, several of the universities, several coding groups. And like, as I went through my final year, I essentially tried to develop what was possible, what was not. And towards the end of that year, we were lucky to launch it into those three organizations. And the rest is history.
Did you plan to launch a business from this, or did this just organically evolve as you went through this process?
Good question. I don't think so. I expected I'd set out to build a company. Did I expect to be doing it for my final year and it to be growing 4 years later? Probably not. I think I had the expectation that I could just solve something for a business. And then I realized that could be a universal solution. And then as I went through the pilot, I found it more of a learning curve to take kind of theory and put into practical solutions. And I think I've always taken that through into my latter years of outside college too. Like, everyone's got an idea, but like, what's plausible? And then what's the buy-in going to be? So it's kind of why I love KeepCup. I appreciate them as a business. I understand what they're trying to do. But it's exactly the same point I put to their general manager, was their theory is fantastic. We'll all buy one of these. We'll carry it around every day. I'll wash it every evening. I'll use it 3-4 times a day, hopefully. But the reality is society's lazy and convenience will always trump that. So although we have to change perspectives, we really probably don't have the time from the environmental standpoint. So it's about making solutions that are quicker and easily adaptive and hopefully nationwide.
I love that, because so many businesses and business ideas are based on the premise that we're these ideal creatures. We're these rational, ethical, you know, oh, we're so planned. We've planned ahead. I love the fact that you've used the human psychology element of things going, well, no, humans are lazy by nature. We all are. Like, as much as we like to say we're not and virtue signal and go, oh, I'm just the most organized person in the world, we're not. I love that you've baked that in. A question occurred to me there while you were chatting about that. So many great projects are done in universities, and I've seen them. I've seen this firsthand. Why do so few make the leap to commercialization?
I think it's a different bubble in a university. I think, you know, for example, there's a demographic that equally, it's a suitable bubble for you to test theory that's in a safety net. The reality is, when you put something out on the main street, it's a very different, I'm not going to say hostile environment, but it's a culture of negative first and positive second, regardless of what the project's actually trying to do. So even with our pilot, we were very, very lucky to have it in two universities that really wanted to push the boundaries of a coffee, like, as simple as that. Like, it was never going to stop there from their side of things. It was, can we move on to change how you'll get your food? Can it move on to change how you'll move around campus?
Yeah, I've often wondered that, and I've never been able to kind of get to the solution of it, because you see so many great
yeah.
projects, and you see so much funds are diverted that way, and then so few are able to make that leap across to commercialization. So I love when I see a project like yourself kind of go from a college project straight out into the world and retain the benefits and retain the great traits of what made it so good as a project in college. So go back to the start and tell me, so you briefly alluded to it there, you were in college, and then when you left college, what was the choice here? Was it no choice? As in like, oh, this is such an obvious thing, I'm definitely going to do it. Or was it like, oh, I'm going to play with this a little bit more? What was it?
I think I had made it my baby at that stage, 10 months realistically behind me of even seeing how like our competitor isn't the Keep Cup, it's the Paper Cup. It's the waste levels. It's the absolute call for like government policy. So I think at that, like we launched and I was in the middle of my final year. Launch day was actually down in Dublin City Council. We had the presidents of both universities, several politicians and so forth. And I, to be honest, I arrived on time and decided I'd go get a coffee because I didn't want to be first in the door. I had actually no indication of this is a big deal. I'm bang on there, grab a coffee and take 20 minutes or so. I walked in the door to about 30 heads staring at me like, where have you been? And I suppose thinking about me, who I've never met in my life, I kind of had... okay, like this is a fascinating like space to be in, that like we're talking about a solution that we thought for it, but like nothing what we had, like the Boston Globe, the UK Times, the Irish Times came out to photograph the journal, covered it with a video. Like I think I then had to then step away from that and go back to a 2 to 4 p.m. exam. And all I was thinking about was how absolutely bonkers this is. And then I think 3 days later, I was on a flight to Germany to investigate reverse vending machines. So I'd say I indirectly or subconsciously knew what my choice was. But of course, when you're sitting down and you're going, the risk that involves, the reality of pilot versus like national acceptance is going to be very different, and international acceptance is going to be even harder. But like nothing really excited me. And that's what probably comes back to, like, you know, a corporate job that wasn't really thrilling me. And then like, you know, another startup, I probably knew I'd want the hands on the wheel in some capacity. I got lucky, I guess.
So when you left college, you had decided, okay, you're going to pursue this in some level. Where do you start with something like that? Because you'd had it as a project and it was in your head as a project. How do you then make that a business? What was your first step?
Well, I was very lucky, in fairness. Like my dad is an entrepreneur, and having a close family member in any capacity is extremely helpful, especially when you're that age. You're kind of like, there's nowhere to begin isn't really taught at any level of the education system. So I got kind of lucky in the sense of he could talk me through like the setting up process and so forth. I'd equally kind of got some mileage under my belt one way or the other, because when I kind of created that project in my internship, the first thing I kind of did was, well, what's viable outside that in the sense of providing cups to other businesses? First actual customers was Opel. So I kind of learned guys are looking for, and then equally like, what's possible after that. So when the pilot kind of came and went, as far as the launch, we had maybe 9 or 10 very large organizations and coffee groups looking to get involved, regardless of the success or not, which was the big thing I kept emphasizing, was we were still looking to see if this will fully work across even 12 weeks, never mind 12 years. So my dad was very good at keeping me level-headed, without doubt.
I find it interesting, your dad is an entrepreneur, that people are always like, oh, what are the patterns, or what do you see from entrepreneurs? You've talked to so many. Generally, there's someone in their orbit. Doesn't have to be a direct family member, but it's an uncle or a friend of the family or someone. They've seen them do it. There's definitely something to that. There's definitely something seeing an entrepreneur in action. And also, I think what you talked about there, the mindset of like, well, if you have an idea and someone will pay you money for it, why wouldn't you do it? The direct line thing.
Why not?
Yeah. And I think that's so interesting to see that in action. And it's the one thing I see over and over and over again is just that, yeah, of course. And I think it's interesting when you look at sports as well. You see so many sports families have that trait of, oh, well, my dad was a professional rugby player and then I was a professional rugby player, my son. It's fascinating. There's definitely there's a really, really interesting case study in that.
Monkey see, monkey do is kind of always the way I looked at it, you know?
Like, I think so. I think it comes down to we are that basic.
You're like, seeing them out of errors. Yeah, it's the out of errors is what I call it. Like if you're watching people when they're not doing the thing, you know, and then you're seeing how they approach problems and they're just sitting at the table trying to figure it out and stuff like that. Like, you indirectly just become part of that one way or the other. So like, even like several of my friends and so forth, like even my close culture would always like testing the boundaries, you know? So like, it didn't feel like a big jump in any capacity for me once I did do it. It just felt like another day. And you kind of do wake up, though, definitely in the first while, where is the direction you're going. So yeah. Having like core values has been really important to me anyway, personally, having like four key principles to stand by, because you get a lot of, especially in what I do, like the first year in the country, like we had requests coming from as far as South Africa, the East and West Coast of America. I've worked with Canada. I've worked with India. I've worked with government groups in Scotland. Like, it's about knowing which is going to be suitable for you, but equally knowing, like, is this your day-to-day, or how do you make that your day-to-day? Mm. You know, you go and, you know, you check your email. It's more like your 6 a.m. and you're like, should I take that meeting at 10 o'clock?
Yeah, it's overwhelming, I think. There definitely is. And I think that's also another reason why it's good to see another entrepreneur, because it can be a little bit, you don't know what to be doing. You're not sure where... should I be doing this? Is this what you do on a Tuesday? Like, what should I, you know, whereas in jobs, you're like, okay, turn up on Monday at 9 and do this until 1, then go for lunch, then come back at 2 and finish that till 5. You know, whereas as an entrepreneur, it's literally like, well, figure it out. You know, especially when you're doing something quite new, doing something that's kind of a market leader, world leader. So it's quite difficult, I would imagine. How have you got your head around that? How have you, okay, you've watched your dad, but how have you felt your way through the project, because what you're doing doesn't really have as a roadmap to follow?
Yeah, I tell you, it's even more applicable as a discussion here, because the startup culture and ecosystem in Ireland is so tech orientated. Mm. It makes physical products very, very like alien to like 90% of like investors or like, you know, shareholders. As far as like people on the street, they think startups, they think tech. When you're telling them you're doing a physical product and you're changing coffee, it becomes a bizarre discussion. I don't know how I've handled it, to be honest. It is very strategic in the sense of what's required or what we're doing. There's no playbook for this. There's absolutely no. There's no like, oh, okay, start a tech company, hopefully go for investment, come up with, you know, your theory, apply it, essentially. There's no none of that. So it's a lot of practical adaption, especially with the projects we'll get asked about. Like, we're a cup company on the face of it, but we'll probably get asked about anything to do with the circular economy. So anything to do with, like, can we remove waste, or can we reduce it, or adapt, we'll accept across different demographics, et cetera, et cetera. It becomes very, very interesting. And that's probably what keeps me so excited all the time. Mm. So, like, you know, we could have airports asking, could we create systems where you get your coffee and drop it at the gate? Then we're getting festivals looking to keep all their cups in-house. Then you've got, like, everything from zoos looking to flow, essentially, and you'll drop it back at the other end. Like, we've worked on a lot of crazy things, and right up to where we were working with the Scottish government on a project to remove single use across 3 cities in one go. So you take your learnings from different success stories.
You seem to be getting exposed to a lot of offers and opportunities. Where do you think they're coming from, considering you're still a relatively young company?
I don't know. I think it's because everyone can wrap their head about what we're doing right now. And I think that's a key part to it. So, you know, a 1 euro deposit and then reapplying that to the mindset of putting a euro in your shopping trolley. What we call paper cups is branded litter now. And equally, that's been matched with the latte levy kind of coming in. That's a tax on these paper cups. So it's a real symbolic piece of waste, essentially, hopefully anyway, going forward. So I think when people think, oh, we could get rid of this, and then they're like, oh, there's a company that do that. And then I think the next part of that kind of discussion is, oh, could they do this? It's because I think our solution is so universal and our core values is to keep it that way, that people think we could probably do more inside it. So it's a mix of what we've done in the past and maybe always being open to hearing what you'd like us to do. And we'll go off and have a think tank for several days on if it's possible or not. Because it's just the culture that I've always liked. Like, nothing is a no until it's not possible. So keeping that even now makes it much easier than to like allow yourself other opportunities to come your way. And it's very, very good.
How do you stay focused, though? Because as a young company, it's like that famous quote, I think it was when, I think it might've been Henry Ford, I might be misattributing, but if I'd asked people what they wanted, they would have said faster horses, not cars. So how do you, it's a great quote, how do you not fall into the faster horses trap? How do you stay true to what you're doing, but not get pulled off in 100 different directions?
Yeah, it comes down to the very beginning, to the honest story in its own self. But basically, and I'll actually name them because they're fantastic here in Ranelagh. Well, I'll give them a shout out because they're trying to do a lot of cool things out there. And when I was starting off, I was selling just reusable cups that could be branded at a much more affordable price. Like, this is right after kind of finding out that we could do this more effectively than KeepCup. And he really, really supported me in getting them in and trying to like promote selling them and stuff like that. And as the pilot launched, we had a very large coffee group come along and ask to sponsor us. And it's a hard thing to turn down. And there was such hype around what we were doing. And they just didn't want to be, they didn't want to be second effectively to this. So actually set us up as a company for several years. It would have been a real benefit to those kind of groups that are involved with them. But I just kept thinking about Nick. I kept thinking about that. And I thought if we put our their name on it, nobody outside of that would get this opportunity. And the difference is the financial saving we'll offer Nick for him taking a punt on me a couple of months earlier would be tenfold the value of what this coffee group would get. And I think that was my first no. So from that, everything else becomes a little easier to say no to be honest. Just the mindset around it. Like, if you can say no to that, what can't you say no to? So it's also about, like, we'd be pretty straightforward as a company. We don't hide away from transparency. If we do not think it's possible, we'll tell you. Or if we don't think we're the right group for it, we'll tell you that too. So it's a bit of managing all of those kind of expectations. And it is a lot, no questions asked, but saying no to the biggest group makes all the other smaller groups easier to decline. And then, to be honest, that's stood to us now. Like, you know, pandemic or not, we had a tough ride around then. Let's look at the other side of this now, and we have 90 plus businesses live at the moment. We have a waiting list of 90 independent businesses just here in Ireland, probably several internationally. We've got a project with Galway City Council, which will be the first in Europe ever. Then we've got two or three other projects, which are including the biggest festival in the country and probably the biggest airport potentially going live. So you say no to some things, but you end up on the other end of it feeling pretty happy.
Okay, so it's a yes until it's a hard no.
Yeah, exactly. Okay. That.
That's good because I think that's, as early stage entrepreneurs, that's hard, right? You do say yes to everything. But I think the key is, like you just said there, the key is to know when no will have a longer term benefit, because if you just keep saying yes and yes and yes, well, you've boxed yourself in. You've cost yourself either time or money or opportunities. So it's, I love that. What's been the biggest difficulty you've come across so far?
Am I allowed to say capital? Is that allowed?
It's absolutely allowed. If it's the answer, it's always allowed. Everything's allowed here.
I wouldn't be a startup if I didn't say it's capital. And I think that's fair to 99.9% anywhere here in the country, if not Europe, and probably further afield anyway. Like, what we're doing is very different, but you can wrap your head around it really quickly, which kind of takes the excitement out of it. At the same time, it's been a slow and steady kind of drive. Like, we've luckily had capital come along at the right points. And I kind of look back even now to put in perspective, we'll start from the beginning. Like, the Environmental Protection Agency backed us, Dublin City Council backed us. We luckily, you know, we had a list of businesses looking to get involved. Then we could kind of take that capital and we could bootstrap it then to the next stage. We had some investors then come in at that point, and now we've just finished an investment round with some of the biggest names, probably country, if not further. So we've been really, really lucky that it probably happened at that time and when it did. However, when I look back, the stress is insane, especially when you've got people knocking on the door to get involved with you, and then you're turning to investors and it's counterintuitive, you know? So like it's always all these businesses want to get involved, and then they're like, well, why do you need me? And you're like, because we need to do this business with them. And it becomes an awkward conversation because there's no excitement in it then per se, going, oh, like we think we'll get these. So that's been a difficult one, especially product-based here in Ireland. Like funds just don't facilitate that. You're looking at angels, you're looking internationally. And we are a company that like to go slow and steady. We like to make sure things work properly before we move on. And that gets difficult too than just going, oh, we'll do 500 right now and good luck, because it'll just create more waste. And that's against the values of the net benefit. So it's been a difficult one, but like, you know, now I'm on the other side of it as of like 3-4 weeks ago. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I can credit a huge amount of people for that. And now I'm going, it's great. It was really easy, you know, like it was just a simple marathon you had to run. But that's been difficult without question. Second probably is core values, as I kind of explained, like the declines, like saying no to different things becomes like, God, will I regret that? And if you're not doubting yourself even a little, like, are you really in it properly? Because, you know, you're going, God, if I did that, though, how insane would that be? So those probably two are definitely neck and neck. And then the other one is, like, it is, you're out, like, you know, coffee's so out there. But, like, coffee cups and changing how you drink a coffee, like, everyone does it. Like, you know, 99% of us here in the country drink a hot beverage. So, like, we're pretty... you're in everyone's hand one way or the other. So therefore that means that everyone's got an opinion, which makes it immensely difficult to kind of shred that down to what's required and what's good info and what's bad info and what's good data. Like, you know, we had 40,000 different consumer points for our pilot, and we built a cup off that. We're 2 years in and we're now at our next stage of a product, which is look back in the 2 years, and we had loads of people saying different things, you know, like the general 80% is class, but then you're always focusing on the other 20, you know, like, oh, I didn't like this, or I wish it was this size, or the lid. Oh, what about wet weather? You think you've thought about all those different things, and then someone comes along who's just seen it for 30 seconds and they've just shredded your dreams in half, and you're like, God damn it. So
it's human nature, isn't it, though?
My background is in product. Yeah, it is, exactly.
You get 100 compliments and you get one negative.
Our culture is just not built for it, you know. Like, we love negative, we thrive on it. I remember going into a tiny old tea room, I think it was in Sligo, and it was a pensioner age woman who just said, I just don't think it's talked through, and she didn't know it was me. Ouch. And I was like, oh, and, you know, like, I still remember that. Like, you're like, oh damn it, like, have I not? And you're doubting it. And then so you have to kind of, I just think if you don't have core values at this stage, especially early on, like, we're only 3.5 years, if you're not holding them into what you're doing, then you're going to sell out at a point where you don't want to. And you'll regret it inevitably, in my opinion. So I just try to stick to what I know at every point, from handling supply chain to product innovation to taking on different customers to expectations. Yeah, it's the mentality. Just be thicker skinned, simple.
What? You've worked with a lot of large organizations, both government bodies and non-government bodies. What are your tips for entrepreneurs who are trying to work with larger bodies? Because it seems to be a roadblock a lot of entrepreneurs stumble with or fall at, is that they can't get through the machine, they can't break through the bureaucracy. What are your tips for working with large organizations and government bodies?
Patience, I think, would be a big one. I think, you know, when you're a small business or effectively an SME, you know, you're ready to move quick. And, you know, sometimes it's really required for you to do that. But there's the reason why they are a machine is there's a lot of moving cogs and it requires a lot of bureaucracy, which is, quite simply, it's a pain in the ass. So if you don't go into it with the immediate understanding this is going to be slower than you hoped, you'll be let down. I think after that, it's about connecting with the human side of what they're trying to do. So, you know, I've worked with 8 or 9 different councils here in Ireland at the lower end of government, I suppose. And, you know, like, some people in there really do genuinely care. Like, they're in this project for the impact it'll have. And then when you get a bit bigger and it's a bit taller and you're dealing with, like, Zero Waste Scotland and so forth, you know, their mentality is to make change. And how can they force change, essentially? So remembering that when they're coming back to you with 100 different pieces of paperwork or questions you would deem silly and so forth. It's actually just them ticking off their boxes and getting in the door. It's not really about, it's just like anything else. It's about finding the right person. Luckily, in this, like, you know, after year one, we kind of had a lot of them coming our way, which was very, very beneficial. Work with who had the best intentions, essentially, or what was the project itself. Like the Galway City Council project, which will be, again, first in Europe. Like, we started these discussions back in June, July. It's now coming to fruition. Just going in and knowing that is a really good first step. And then finding the right people. If you know, a cold lead, essentially, it's just about like, okay, well, what department should I talk to? And treating it in that sense, like, okay, I've got a solution here that'll affect waste levels. You know, I've got something that'll speed up the paperwork process in finance. Talk directly to finance. Don't, dear sir, madam, put it to a phone call and find out who is actually the John you need to talk to or the Margaret who's got the info. And taking it from there will make it much easier because a lot of these people talk anyway. Different government bodies will definitely discuss it regularly. So if you've got something that might suit them and they worked previously in another government department or another government body, like, they'll have someone you should move to. And that's where the lead then progresses.
It's a really good answer. I think patience is the key, isn't it? Yeah. As a startup, we kind of forget that. It's all about, oh, hustle and grind and push harder and push harder. Sometimes it is just having patience and just chipping away. I loved your point there on dear John, dear Susan, dear Sarah. Knowing your audience is critical. Like, too many people blast out dear sir, madams, and then just wonder why they're not getting replies. Of course you're not, because they've got 100 of them this week alone. You're not making them feel special. They're not getting the love. You sound like a busy dude. How do you balance all this? How do you plan, say, bring me through, say, your week, your fortnight, your month? How do you plan it, and then how do you make it happen?
Okay. Great support systems and networks. I'm really, really lucky to have a phone with a lot of great friends inside there. And, like, you know, my girlfriend's extremely understanding since she's head of marketing. So shout out to Kelly Ann Brennan. Equally to Philip Hall and Stephanie Stewart, they're the key members of this. But I think it's about going to have people you can vent to, essentially, is a good coping mechanism. And I think that's key to it. So having people who, you know, you can explain what's going on in your day to day, your week or your month, or the problems you're having, is so essential. And ones who will just listen, you know, like, you don't need answers. You just need space to escape, essentially. Other than that, like, you know, and it would probably be said regularly, is I won't ever get a chance to switch off. And I've kind of accepted that in myself, you know, that's kind of just my own reality, and I kind of am really comfortable in that reality, that I will probably be on 99% of the time. And even when I'm out chilling or exercising or anything like that, I'll probably subconsciously be working on something, and that keeps me excited anyway, to be honest. You know, like, I love what I do, so it's not really, it doesn't feel like work. I'd be lying if I said it did. It feels more like a really weird adventure, and I don't know where it's going next. It's safe, but it doesn't excite me. But the words I use a lot, like, it needs to really thrill me. So on my day to day, like, I will probably have my week process lined up, that's required. And then I will go day by day in that. So taking in the moment in that sense of, okay, I will literally have a notepad that'll have Monday to Friday. And I'll have the day before that, I'll have what's required of me in that week. And then it's about going day to day of, oh, I need to do that tomorrow. So that'll be my week. Exercise 3 times a week at least. Then after that, it's just good food and trying to relax, you know, as much as that's physically possible. They're kind of the key parts to it on a weekly basis. On a monthly and quarterly, it's managing finances. It's, you know, analyzing cup quantities. It's understanding where the flow and the change in hospitality, which has been very hostile, I suppose is the word, over the last 2 years. And outside of those parts, it's just keeping something that will keep you relaxed in your plans. You know, like, if it's a holiday, it's a spa day, it doesn't matter what. Like, it's just having that kind of like, okay, I've got that escape to move towards. I'll take it then. You know, that kind of way. Good family, good friends, no questions asked. Like, I don't know if I could do any of this if I didn't have them, you know, without question. Like, family has been really, really key. And especially at my age, you know, like, I'm now getting older, it feels. I feel like I'm really old. I feel like I've got 20 years under my belt in mine. Like, you know, oh, what were you doing today? Like, oh, I was speaking to 60 hospitality businesses in a conference in Galway. Then I came home and did a brief phone call with, like, you know, a tiny cafe who's very worried but really eager to get going. And, like, and, you know, you've got finance questions, you've got questions from investors. So, like, my day is just never going to be normal. And then accepting that, working with good people, of course, too. I just don't believe in a culture of 9 to 5. I know how stupid that sounds to say, and it's very startup-esque, but like, if you work better starting later, why on earth would I want you in at 9 a.m. there? Like, really, you're physically, but you're not mentally. And then, you know, with our job too, like, hospitality doesn't work to those hours, so why should we? Like, if you come in and you crunch out 4 fantastic hours, like, there's no point wasting time, you know, other than that. I question a lot, I suppose, is the main point of that.
How do you hold yourself accountable? How do you make sure you are working on the correct things?
Yeah, good question. I think the people around me do. And I think that's really important, that, like, you know, I'll be fairly vocal with goals. I'll be fairly vocal with what we want to achieve. So I'll know indirectly that if they aren't made, it's not the only person who doesn't feel that's not made. There's a couple of who I'll keep, obviously, in the back pocket. I don't want to show all my cards, but, like, you know, what budget we're going to hit this month, and, like, going over that and stuff, like, those kind of things, if you're not transparent with it, you're not really being held accountable by anyone. So having that, like, out there, this is the plan, this is what we're going to do, makes everyone also very clear on what the plan is and why we're making this decision. But yeah, transparency, I think, helps with accountability.
I love that. It's something I've been thinking about a lot recently, because it keeps coming up in chats with entrepreneurs, is that their biggest challenge is accountability, keeping themselves accountable, especially during COVID. I think when everyone was a little bit isolated, accountability seems to have been the one thing that people have really struggled with. Even the most disciplined people have struggled with it. You mentioned something interesting there about hospitality changing over the last couple of years. What have you seen?
Oh, loads. God, when we did the pilot, people knew Keep Up and they should stock them on the shelf. And that was kind of, that began and ended there. After that, it kind of shifted towards single use being really questioned. So I was flown to a conference with the Scottish government where I debated Keep Cup, and a Scottish member of parliament, and Hubbub, a non-profit. It was amazing. Like, it was just such a surreal experience. I graduated, I think, the week before. So it was really weird to be at this now. Like, we had just about built our To Go Cup, like the one that's out there at the moment. And I remember, like, we were getting great with Keep Cup. We went up on that stage. There was 600 people in the room, a whole press team lined up at the very beginning. I'm getting mic'd up. I was going, my God, what the hell is going on? I remember that, like, they had a clip of Boris Johnson being and then an advisor walking by and taking it out of his hand because he couldn't be seen with it. And I remember going, like, wow, people probably remember that clip. Like, you know, he's going, what's going on for like those 5 seconds, and another coffee is handed into his hand. But kind of the beginning, I think I realized, like, there is a real shift here of, like, at the top level down of, we need to change this. And then over that kind of period of time, we had, like, it was a struggle. Like, I was really lucky. Like, one of my best friends came on as biz dev manager. And he really kind of, like, helped me flourish in the sense of, like, how do we get cafes signed up? Like, there's no process here. Like, what quantity do we recommend? Like, you know, how many they're going to need? What's the return rate? And we had 2-3 fantastic months before the pandemic hit. And, you know, like, I make the joke regularly, like, we became essentially a call center from March onwards. Mm-hmm. Like, everyone just rang us and thought, like, we would have, like, the health standards for a pandemic. You know, we were like, we're learning as the news goes too. Like, we're watching Leo Varadkar's speech. So I look back and 80% of our business dropped off the plant, you know, like, really quickly. And that was like, okay, what are we going to do here? And if it wasn't for the fact that I was appointed then to the Global Emergency Reuse Task Force, which was put together by City to Sea, a nonprofit in the UK, but it had a member of government across maybe 20 countries, including the Scottish government, which gave me a little bit of a buddy in there. And on top of that, we had, like, the Lord Mayor's office. We had someone from the WHO from New York. So it gave me a real 3 to 6 months of, like, sitting in on these meetings and effectively hearing what's happening on reuse. You know, we were in lockdown. There was no indication of Togo Cup coming back. Like, what is the plan? And then, you know, 6, 9, maybe 12 months later, then we started seeing a flourish of businesses. And one of them was a hospital. St. James's Hospital was one of the first businesses then to come back and be like, we want to stop our single use. It's flying out the door. Since then, to jump ahead a bit, we've got maybe 13 hospitals. I think 9 have started, another 4 to go. And we'd like to make every hospital in the country reuse only. So that kind of correlated with the trend. And then, you know, in the last 3 to 6 months, I think everyone's just been trying to find their feet, which has been difficult. Then now we've seen a real turn where single use is, like, you know, ignoring the cost of these cups from the consumer side to the waste level, but to the businesses themselves have really changed. And now reuse seems to be the top priority. And we're really lucky to be hopefully trailblazing in that industry.
You seem to have been catapulted into some really unusual situations and some situations you probably didn't feel 100% qualified maybe or suitable or how did I wake up here?
Oh yeah. That was a very polite way of saying it, Gary.
Years of practice. Do you ever suffer from imposter syndrome?
Yeah, absolutely. Like, God, how could you not? Like, you know, I went for like 2 or 3 pints before I spoke twice at that conference in 2 full rooms of 600 people. Right. And I went for 2 or 3 pints the night before. Like, I was not on edge by any capacity here. Like, I needed to be at my A game. 2 or 3 coffees were certainly had when I walked into the room. And I was like, they were wondering how I came through the front door. Like, they were like, oh, you came through the front. And I was like, yeah. And like, this was a major atrium. They were like, yeah, you could just come around the back. And I was like, okay. I didn't realize I was in, essentially, which was not briefed on me, of course. Like, don't tell them at all what's going on. I just thought I was coming over to discuss coffee with Keep Cup and us. So it was a surreal moment when I look back. And I've been to China where we manufacture. I've been to our factory floor. You know, I didn't have any experience. And, you know, what am I looking for here? Like, what's the plan? I've analyzing our supply chain at 23 years old, you know, like with no history or academic background in supply chain, working with guys who, you know, provide plastic to Hershey's. US, like, not just a part of it, Hershey's as a whole. So I was catapulted into loads of crazy situations over the last 3.5 years. I think I just need to know what I'm doing. And equally, to be honest, I'd be lying if I said it doesn't come up that I could be 20 years younger than everyone in the room, in a lot of rooms. So, like, from a corporate level, it gets very interesting. So I think it's just sticking to your guns, knowing what you are. And, you know, even if you're on the front of it going, oh my God, like, just remember leveling yourself off and going, look, you know what you can do and what's possible and why you've done it. So every decision I tried to make, especially early on, had to be data driven. Like, even the cup being built was based on info. It wasn't just, oh, well, I'd love to see. It was based on all these other people telling me what they wanted. So I was just trying to feed that into what's expected. So that meant then when I stood up in front of anyone or there was questions on it, it made it a lot easier to go through that kind of imposter syndrome. And if you're not confident as the CEO, well, how can you last to be confident too? So that's been a big, big part of it, without question.
If you went back, if you're chatting to Kevin from a couple of years ago, is there one thing or even a couple of things you'd be like, here's the things to look out for, here's what I would do differently?
Yeah, you make mistakes along the way. I don't know if I'd look back and say, do it differently. There's definitely things like, I wish I strategized knowing what I knew a little bit later, like, you know, like just an inch more info. But like, I'm a slow decision maker in its own right, you know, like I won't jump the gun really quickly on things because I won't have all the facts mostly. And I try to think through as much of it as I can when I'm switched off. So like, I don't know if I look back and say anything was done differently. Like, I kind of fell into it around 21, 22. And all I just wanted to do then, which is probably the same now, is just solve something. Like, if I could just solve it. And like, that gets me really excited if I could solve a problem. Like, small or big, it doesn't really matter. So like, I'll take that into, you know, whatever happens with Togo Cup or whatever happens after. I think my mindset would probably be that. If I'd go back and change any decision I've made, I don't think so. It's all got me here and I'm pretty happy here.
I love that answer.
I wasn't, I'm screwed. So
that's a great answer. Yeah, no, it's like, true. Like it's, you don't know what you don't know, right? You sometimes you just have to do these things to figure it out. And you couldn't, even if you told Kevin, he'd be like, yeah, sure, future Kevin, I'll definitely do that. Not. So like it's, sometimes you just have to figure out, you just have to do the thing. What is the goal, Kevin? What is the big, I need to get some clips for 5 and 10 years time when this is a massive success. What's the goal? I want to get some Gary Vee style clips. I need to start thinking ahead when you're a billionaire. What's the goal to Go Cup?
I think it is to just have it. There's several now. The first one will be that when I want to walk into a coffee shop one day and ask for it in a paper cup and I want them to be, I think that would be an ultimate goal. I think I would love to have it that what is the typical normal now has been changed by us, that becomes unusual. I think that as a universal kind of solution would be really cool. Other than that, I think I just want to have a reality of the next 5 or 10 years with To Go Cup that we just keep changing things. Like I just want us to keep changing things no matter what. Like I don't have, you know, oh, I want to have a, you know, the cup with an LED screen on the side of it so people can see advertising. I just want to always take on projects that'll change the status quo. And I think I've always loved that. I think it's just anything that kind of knocks things on its head and makes people think would be great. Like even getting people thinking is class for me. You know, like I luckily I've had a couple of talks over my time, and I remember there was one student who came up to me from university not too long ago, to be honest, and said, like, it just got me thinking. And I just thought that was cool.
Yeah.
Like that was cool. Better than anything else, you know, like, I got 4 feckin' SWOT analysis points for this. Like it was more like, oh, like that got me thinking, like, what could I do?
Love that.
Or like I had someone saying to me, like, he's gonna build an e-commerce site for his bikes or something. Like that stuff is just that's sick. So if I look back in 5 or 10 years and I can think back to those moments more so, I'd be really happy. And if we happen to do some mad stuff along the way, like, yeah, that'd be the goal.
That's a class answer. I love that. Just do cool things and have fun doing it. It's as good as it gets, right? We all overthink this stuff. We all try to think of like, oh, well, my 5-year plan is this and my 10-year plan is that. Do cool stuff and
You have different answers. Like, exactly. Like, you know, if you're not enjoying it, like, what the hell is the point? It's already stressful enough. Like, it honestly, it's already stressful enough. So if you don't enjoy the heck out of it, like, it becomes a waste. And you can see how you hear a lot about, like, startup burnout and stuff like that. And, like, I get that completely, you know? Like, you can get how you get tired. So I think if you're not like, oh, this is cool, like, oh, like, if you've lost that, then a lot of it then gets, that's fairly boring, and go do something boring then.
You got to stack the deck in your favor, exactly like you say. It's going to be hard enough without you making it even harder on yourself. Is there a book that's kind of made an impact on you personally or professionally on the journey?
Good question. Okay. I think reading a book is not more so about the book. And I think that's really cool. And I think that's key as well. So I was traveling Southeast Asia right after, God, was it my second year of college or third year of college essentially. So I was going into my final year, if I have that right. And To Go Cup, I was trying to do at the same time with the time difference, which was nuts. And that was really difficult, but I read Joyland by Stephen King. And it's basically a book, and I didn't expect it because I just love Stephen King. And basically it's a story of a young guy kind of coming of age. Effectively, he left college and went to work in a circus at this kind of town out of nowhere. And the whole backstory is, oh, there's a ghost there, but it's irrelevant. It's more like this guy just being like, I just did something mad and I kind of found myself doing it. I thought that was really good because I was like traveling and taking in what I want to do with To Go Cup, and everything was taken off and all those things. So that was a really good time to read it. And then the other one is How Bad Do You Want It by Matt Fitzgerald. I don't know if that's come up before.
It's getting very popular.
Really? Oh, cool. Okay. And this is basically a collection of stories from a journalist who covers a huge amount of ultra sports, essentially. And instead of telling the stereotypical, oh, he trained really hard and, you know, he ran this unreal race and he beat the world record and stuff like that. It also tells you the background of like, yeah, so you didn't know that he went an absolute drinking bender for 4 days before the race and still trumped the record. Or, you know, he just got told his wife has got cancer just before he went out and ran. And it was how bad do you want it is kind of the universal taking he's had over 20 years of talking to these guys off the record. And just the like, yeah, like, oh, you thought this was easy just because, you know, I trained really hard and you thought that was the hard part. It was like, no, like personal circumstances were tenfold a pain in the ass at the time. So I think I took a look at the beginning of the lockdown and I think it gave me a bit of purpose as well. Like, you know, nothing is as it seems. I think everyone accepts that. But like the difficulty around, oh yeah, like you think I went through just, oh, I started a cup company, then I ended up falling into a pilot. Oh, and then I built a product and I went to China and then I came back and was speaking with that. And none of that was planned, but equally none of that was easy. But like when I get to write it out one day, hopefully it'll come across that way. So the off the record stuff will be the amazing part to that. And I think that's why I enjoyed it so much.
I love that answer. That's class. It's not planned, but it's not easy. That's brilliant. That's because it sums it up perfectly. They're too great. I'm definitely going to get the How Bad Do You Want It. That sounds like a
good yeah, it's unreal. Really would recommend it. Like it's a slow burn, and like you have to really accept. Like the even the narrative is really good because it starts with like, oh, this is how successful it was. Like 3-time world record, 3 races in a row, and then it gets into, oh yeah, this is terrible. This is also what was going on.
Yeah, and that's reality, so, right? Yeah. That's why I love doing these pods, because people always love the narrative of like, I did this, I got that, and now I'm here. And then they look backwards going, oh yeah, you know, I look back at it now, they were the best days of my life. No, they weren't. They were really hard. They were really tough. There was all sorts of stuff going on that no one ever knew about. And now you're here. But equally, I think it's really, really, really important to share the journeys along the way and to go, yeah, look, yeah, that sums it up brilliant. I'm going to rob that gratuitously. I may credit you, I may not, but I'm going to take that.
Go for it.
It's not planned, but it's not easy.
Now when we get off the phone.
Copyright Kevin Murphy 2022. Kevin, where can people learn a little bit more about Go Cup?
Yeah, so to learn more, I'd probably say go to our website, so www.gocup.ie. You'll find a lot of us on socials, all platforms, so just give us a search. Drop us a DM, let us know what you're thinking. Equally, you can find myself on Twitter. You can find me on Twitter. Don't come near me on LinkedIn. I'll say it pretty openly. Yeah, there you go.
Perfect. Listen, Kevin, thanks so much for joining us.
Thanks a million. Appreciate it, Gary.
Hope you enjoyed my chat with Kevin. What a cool guy. That's a really interesting story. I think we can all embrace Kevin's mentality. Do cool stuff. Have some fun while you're doing it, and business will be easy. I will see you back here next Monday for the Idea Lab. Have a great week, and I'll talk to you then.